of his mind. It would be best if you found him before he finds you. When the internet cafe opened, he would pay his €3 fee in coins, plug in the external search engine, and begin developing a pattern of life on Lieutenant Commander James Reese. Author's note: this is a work of fiction. Fiction with whispers of truth. On August 7th, 2020, Al-Qaeda's second-in-command, Abu Muhammad al-Masari, was assassinated. It is rumored that the gunmen were Israeli operatives acting with tacit or explicit support from the United States. Also killed in the assassination was the widow of Hamza bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's son. The assassination took place in Tehran, Iran. In the fall of 2017, I had a remarkable conversation with a man in Argentina. He will remain anonymous in this work, though he is mentioned by name in the 9/11 Commission report. He asked me how 19 foreign nationals could pass through security at 3 separate international airports and 1 regional airport, some even flagged for additional screening, and not have 1 report in subsequent investigations of a screener noticing a box cutter or knife. The regulations pertaining to knives allowed on aircraft prior to September 11, 2001 were confusing. Federal Aviation Administration regulations prohibited knives with blades 4 inches long or longer and/or knives illegal under local law. Seemingly in contradiction to that regulation was a non-regulatory checkpoint operations guide for screeners interpreting those FAA regulations and prohibiting box-cutting devices. For 19 terrorists to pass through screening without 1 security screener at least noticing a blade and ensuring it was of legal length struck him as odd. That conversation provided the basis for The Devil's Hand. The first sentence of the notes to Chapter 1 of the 9/11 Commission report reads, "No physical, documentary, or analytical evidence provides a convincing explanation of why Atta and Omari drove to Portland, Maine from Boston on the morning of September 10th. 20 years later, that question has still not been successfully answered. Mohammed Atta and Abdulaziz al-Omari took that secret with them to their graves. On the topic of Iranian involvement in 9/11, the report states, "We have found no evidence that Iran or Hezbollah was aware of the planning for what later became the 9/11 attack. However, we believe this topic requires further investigation by the U.S. government." The report also notes that at least 8 of the 9/11 terrorists traveled to Iran between October 2000 and February 2001. Tehran is believed to have been a waypoint in travel to and from terrorist training camps in neighboring Afghanistan. There is evidence that suggests senior Hezbollah officials were aware of and actively tracking the travel of these Al-Qaeda operatives. To what purpose remains unknown. Al-Qaeda, Iran, and Hezbollah have an incestuous history. The foundations of the relationship were laid in the early 1980s with the founding of Islamic Jihad, but were cemented during the 1990s when Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, then Al-Qaeda's second-in-command, took refuge in Sudan. In the 1990s, Sudan was a breeding ground for terror. Chapter 2 of the 9/11 Commission report notes, "In late 1991 or 1992, discussions in Sudan between Al-Qaeda and Iranian operatives led to an informal agreement to cooperate in providing support, even if only training, for actions carried out primarily against Israel and the United States. Not long afterward, senior Al-Qaeda operatives and trainers traveled to Iran to receive training in explosives. In the fall of 1993, another such delegation went to the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon for further training in explosives as well as in intelligence and security. From Sudan, Al-Qaeda sent operatives to train in Iran and Lebanon. In April 1991, Ayman al-Zawahiri traveled to Iran and met with Hezbollah Operations Chief Imad Mughniyeh. Mughniyeh was responsible for the 1983 bombings of the U.S. Embassy and Marine Barracks in Beirut, the kidnapping and murder of CIA Lebanon Station Chief William F. Buckley, the hijacking of TWA Flight 847 in 1985, the 1992 suicide bombing of the Israeli Embassy in Buenos Aires, the 1994 attack on a Jewish community center in Argentina, and the 1996 Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia. Mughniyeh would later meet with bin Laden in Sudan, further bridging the Sunni-Shia divide and cementing the al-Qaeda connection with the regime in Tehran. 2 days prior to 9/11, Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, was assassinated by two al-Qaeda operatives posing as journalists. A declassified, though heavily redacted, November 2001 Defense Intelligence Agency cable obtained through the Freedom of Information Act by the National Security Archive at George Washington University reads, "Through Northern Alliance intelligence efforts, the late Commander Massoud gained limited knowledge regarding the intentions of the Saudi millionaire Osama bin Laden and his terrorist organization al-Qaeda to perform a terrorist act against the U.S. on a scale larger than the 1998 bombing of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Massoud's al-Qaeda assassins obtained their forged documents via the Iranian embassy in Brussels." One of the most damning pieces of evidence on Iran's complicity in 9/11 comes from a classified Iranian document dated May 2001, a transcript of which can be found in Ronan Bergman's The Secret War with Iran. The Islamic Republic of Iran, the intelligence apparatus of the Supreme Leader, top secret. Date May 14, 2001. Reference 4-325-80/S/M. By Head of the Intelligence Apparatus of the Supreme Leader, 2. Head of Operations Unit No. 43 in the Iranian Intelligence Ministry. Re. Orders regarding the decision of the Honorable Leader Khamenei. Dear Hujjat al-Islam wal-Muslimin Mustafa Purkanad, Director of General Operations, Unit No. 43. We wish your dedicated and courageous team every success. The results described in your recent reports have been examined along with other opinions. After consideration and in order to remove the existing lack of clarity regarding support for al-Qaeda's future plans, the Honorable Leader has emphasized that the battle against the global arrogance headed by the U.S. and Israel is an integral part of our Islamic government and constitutes its primary goal. Damaging their economic systems, discrediting all other institutions of these two allied enemies of the Islamic government in Iran, as part of political confrontation with them and undermining the stability and security of the U.S. and Israel are obligatory duties that must be carried out. The Honorable Leader Khamenei stressed the need for each of you to be vigilant in his field of activity and asks you to be particularly attentive. He also stressed the need to be alert to the possible negative future consequences of this cooperation between Iran and al-Qaeda. The Honorable Khamenei said that this struggle must be stepped up by tightening the collaboration with other security and intelligence apparatuses in Iran and with supporters outside Iran, thereby hindering the enemy's steadily expanding activities. Khamenei further instructed that in carrying out your duties, you must operate under the direct supervision of the Security Division of the headquarters of the organization, i.e., the intelligence apparatus of the Supreme Leader. Naturally, identifying potential damage is the responsibility of the Vigilant and Diligent Unit, number 43. It has also been decided that in the upcoming meetings, discussions must be held in order to formulate clear goals and remove the main obstacles and difficulties in achieving these goals and in promoting the issue of expanding the collaboration with the fighters of al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, Lebanon. Finally, I wish to convey Khamenei's full satisfaction with Unit Number 43 and his full support in the implementation of its future plans. The Honorable Khamenei is aware of the important and dangerous nature of the tasks you perform. He emphasizes that with regard to cooperation with Al-Qaeda, no traces must be left that might have negative and irreversible consequences, and that the activity must be limited to the existing contacts with Hezbollah Operations Officer Imad Mughniya and bin Laden's deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri. May Allah grant you success. Seal and signature, Ali Akbar Natek Nouri. Ali Akbar Natek Nouri was the chief advisor on intelligence to Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran. Following the death of Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri ascended to lead al-Qaeda. The United States Department of State has offered a reward of $25 million for information leading to al-Zawahiri's apprehension or conviction. At the time of this writing, he remains at large. I was well into the research for this novel before the COVID-19 pandemic gripped the world. I was investigating the weaponization of infectious diseases, particularly from the end of World War II through today. It did not escape notice when information began to emerge that a variant of coronavirus had emerged in a market in Wuhan, China, just 3 football fields from Wuhan's Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market, where China tells the world that the COVID-19 outbreak originated, is the Wuhan branch of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. That same market is less than 10 miles from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which houses China's only biosafety level 4 laboratory, called the Wuhan National Biosafety Laboratory. On February 16, 2020, Senator Tom Cotton said, "We have such laboratories ourselves in the United States run by our military, in large part done for preventative purposes or trying to discover vaccines or protect our own soldiers." The key part of the senator's interview is that we have such laboratories ourselves. Unintended release of biological and chemical weapons is not without precedent. In 1979, a Soviet research lab in what was then called Sverdlovsk in the Urals accidentally released anthrax, killing at least 100 people. The facility was using data from Imperial Japan's bioweapons program captured in Manchuria during World War II. The medical records of those exposed to anthrax were all edited to limit evidence that the Soviets were in violation of the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention, of which they were signatories. The deaths were explained away as coming from contaminated meat. In 1968, 6,000 sheep mysteriously died near Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. Dugway was established during World War II in an effort to counter the Axis biological and chemical weapons programs. It remains in existence today. The U.S. Army had been conducting open-air VX nerve agent testing in the days prior to what is now called the Skull Valley Sheep Kill. An internal Army investigation 2 years later would find that lethal chemical agents tested at Dugway on March 13, 1968, may have contributed to the sheep deaths. The history of biological weapons is both fascinating and chilling. Bioweapons data from Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany in World War II informed the U.S. and Soviet bioweapons programs of the Cold War years. In the spring of 2002, I was part of a small group of military personnel assigned to a training mission in Uzbekistan. As the junior member of the team, my job was to train up partner force snipers on the SDV, better known as the Dragunov. It was during this assignment to Uzbekistan that I first heard mention of an island on the Aral Sea, an island synonymous with bioweapon research. My later open-source research would indicate that this was Vozrozhdeniya Island, Rebirth Island, a former Soviet biological weapons test site called Aralsk 7. It is clear that the Soviets had not adhered to the United Nations Treaty. The history of Marburg variant U described in The Devil's Hand is true. Dr. Nikolai Ustinov worked at the Vector Bioweapon Research Center in Koltsovo, Siberia. In April 1988, he accidentally injected Marburg into his thumb. He was immediately quarantined. Over the next 3 weeks, the virus liquefied his organs and drove him insane as it ate away his brain cells. Ever the scientist, he detailed his demise in a journal, its pages stained with blood, vomit, and mucus from his decaying body. Following his death, organ samples were taken. During his autopsy, a doctor pricked his skin with a needle that had extracted bone marrow. He was dead a month later. Upon further study, the samples of Marburg taken from Dr. Ustinov's organs appeared different from the original strain. The virus had evolved. It was now more virulent than the original. The Soviets weaponized this new strain and called it Variant U in honor of Dr. Ustinov. By all indications, the Soviet Union stepped up their bioweapon development and stockpiling programs following the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. Biopreparat was the lead Soviet agency tasked with weaponizing infectious diseases. What happened to these programs with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991? What happened to the scientists who developed these programs? According to Dr. Ken Alibek, the deputy chief of Biopreparat from 1988 to 1992, many of his former colleagues relocated to the United States, Europe, and Asia, as economic conditions in Russia forced scientists to look for work beyond their borders. In Chapter 20 of his book, Biohazard, he writes, "In May of 1997, more than 100 scientists from Russian laboratories, including Vector and Obolensk, attended a biotechnology trade fair in Tehran. Soon after that, Iranians had visited Vector a number of times and were actively promoting scientific exchanges." How far along is the Iranian bioweapons program, and does the success of using proxies over the past four decades mean that Iran could or would use these weapons through non-state actors as an instrument of terror? It is certainly a possibility and should not be discounted. Has the United States remained in compliance with the 1972 Biological Weapon Convention? There is no international agency tasked with verification to monitor compliance. It's essentially the honor system. The convention bans bioweapon agents, toxins, weapons, equipment, and means of delivery. We would be naive to assume that classified bioweapons programs do not still exist. Interestingly, the language of what is officially called the Convention on the Prohibition of the Development, Production, and Stockpiling of Bacteriological, Biological, and Toxin Weapons, BTWC, does not ban biodefense weapons. Does the United States have protocols in place to eradicate a respiratory spread virus that threatens to kill 90% of the population? I don't know the answer to that question, but inferring what I can from the research for this novel, I would be surprised if those plans do not exist. If you were experimenting with the weaponization of viruses, even biodefense weapons, that had the potential to render the human race extinct, what would you do? Following the targeted assassination of Quds Force Commander General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said, "With his departure and with God's power, his work and path will not cease, and severe revenge awaits those criminals who have tainted their filthy hands with his blood." Iran does not forget. Of note, the United States signed the Biological Weapons Convention on April 10, 1972. The same day as Iran.
The Devil's Hand, a thriller, was written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter. Editing, mix, and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. The Devil's Hand was produced and directed by Travis Tunn. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Devil's Hand, a thriller, is available in print from Atria Emily Bestler Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Savage Son, a thriller, written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.